The Writer's Voice. To celebrate our 30 years of service, Virginia Voice's Patty Campbell talks to noted writers about their lives and work.
We're very, very happy to welcome the Richmond Times-Dispatch columnist, Bill Lohman. Bill, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Patty. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
We've been enjoying the new column.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about writing a column. Is that what you've primarily done?
I've done a little bit of everything, and I started out reporting and writing and doing sports and news and everything else. And the column is a little bit, possibly a stronger voice is what I aim for. I like to do what we kind of call feature columns, which are about other people or about things that are going on, not so much opinions, but I try to write them from a perspective that is more my perspective, so I'm telling the story.
How do you find the people that you're going to talk with or about in your columns?
It's easier than you would think. A lot of people call and people tell me about other people and about things that are going on, and one thing leads to another, and often I'll go out on one story and find two others. So the ideas come from just about anywhere and anybody.
Is it fun?
Oh, yes. I wouldn't be doing it if it wasn't.
Not sort of back-breaking pressure to come up with another idea?
Oh, no, there's no heavy lifting. Well, there is some pressure to... And I'm starting to feel it now with the new column. They want two a week, and that's a little different than what I've done in the past. But there's always the pressure in the sense of wanting to make sure I have things planned out down the road so I know I've got something for next week. And, of course, that always can change when something else better comes along and I can push those others back. But you always want to make sure you've got something in mind so that you're not sitting there 2 hours from deadline not knowing what you're going to write about.
You mentioned the past, and I know that you've brought a few things today from the past to read for us. But your past is pretty much the news business, isn't it? Did I hear that you got started at this in the fifth grade?
That's right. My family needed money for food. No, that's not exactly right. When I was in the fifth grade, I started carrying the paper, the news leader, because I grew up in Richmond. So I've been sort of in the news business since I was about 11, I guess. I tried to make them consider that for part of my retirement package, but I don't think they bought that. So.
But you did start as a writer with the news leader too, right?
Yes. Well, I came back to the news leader. My first job out of college was in Charlottesville. I was a sports writer, and then I worked for several years for United Press International in Richmond and Orlando and Atlanta. And then I came home to the news leader to work in 1988. So I spent 21 years of my career here, but I did have about 8 years before that with other people.
And you are one of the reporters who made the transition from the news leader to the Times-Dispatch.
That's right. I was involved in the merger. I was a reporter for the news leader, and then when the papers merged, I became a feature writer.
Okay. Well, we're interested in hearing some of the things that you have written. What have you brought for us?
I brought some of my older columns. I used to do a column back in the mid-90s and in the early part of this decade for the Flair section, and it was geared more about family matters, and it was family issues and about things with my family and other people's families. That was sort of the topic. One of my former editors had come to me after I started having kids, and I actually stayed home with my kids during their first months. Took some family leave, so I had some real parenting experience, and mostly of the humorous variety, and I would write about them occasionally. He suggested I do a weekly column about that, so that's what I did, and I brought a few examples of that.
Great. Now, how many kids? And
I have three.
Boys, girls?
I have a girl who's 21, another girl who's 15, and my son is 12.
Okay. Well, let's hear something.
Or this first one was from 1997. Our youngest, our son, was less than a year old, and I decided I was on taking family leave at the time, so I was off during the day, and of course off meaning I was at home taking care of them. So it was in May, and I decided we'd go out to an afternoon baseball game at the Diamond. So that's the setup for this. As I was tucking in the three-year-old after an evening of bedtime stories that, if strung together end-to-end, would simply be one more thing to trip over in our house, I mentioned that I hoped to take her, along with her sister and brother, to a baseball game the next afternoon. "I don't want to go to a baseball game," she announced. "But," I explained, "not only would we see wonderful competition while relaxing in a sun-drenched stadium, we also would have the opportunity to eat really bad food at really high prices." "Maybe I do want to go to the ball game," she announced. It's all in the delivery. One of the pleasures of working part-time at the moment is that I'm home during the week, so I can go to the ballpark in broad daylight on a Wednesday without fear of being seen by, say, an editor. So there we were, the four of us, the 9-year-old, the 3-year-old, the 7-month-old, and old and growing older by the moment Dad, heading for the diamond on a warm, bright afternoon. It was a great day to play two, as Ernie Banks used to say. But we would be lucky to see one, given the attention span of certain middle children and the disposition of the youngest, who was making his first trip to a ballpark. Traffic was a bit of a problem, so by the time we got there, the game was in the second inning, and two of the three in my charge were asleep. The walk is very long from the parking lot beyond center field to the box office behind home plate when you are carrying a baby in a car seat and leading a groggy 3-year-old by the hand. Mercifully, the 9-year-old hauled the bag full of bottles, toys, wipes, and diapers. We bought general admission tickets and found just the right seats, far enough away from everyone else along the first baseline. Things proceeded just fine until somebody became thirsty and hungry and insisted on having a drink and a hot dog. Finally, the kids couldn't ignore me any longer, so we ate. The 9-year-old is an old hand at watching baseball, but still needs a little help with some of the intricacies of the game. The 3-year-old doesn't know a pop fly from a house fly and didn't care to learn. I tried to explain about balls and strikes and hits and outs, but she grew weary of my educational efforts and moved to the empty row behind us. She returned briefly to toss the last of her hot dog bun into her big sister's drink. Every team looks forward to a big inning, and ours was the fourth. In the top of the inning, I fed the baby a bottle. In the bottom half, he cut loose with a burp that sounded like a line drive ricocheting around the metal bleachers. Then he and I being the one doing the actual chasing, gracefully chased a foul ball that came out our way, but wouldn't you know it, took a bad hop into the hands of a kid 10 rows in front of us. Then the 3-year-old proclaimed she needed to visit the bathroom, despite the fact she went just before leaving home. As usual, the trip was fun. She's at the age now when she observantly notices shoes in the next stall and likes to loudly comment on her observations. We hurriedly washed our hands and left. On the way back to our seats, she suddenly needed a drink of water. What was this, bedtime? But we couldn't find a working water fountain. The game was well played and exciting, but went into extra innings, which is not the best thing when you've got two fidgety kids and another who was getting hungry and really wanted to go home to mom. So I made an executive decision to leave in the top of the 10th inning. As we made the long walk back to the car, this time I carried the car seat, the baby, and the 3-year-old, the winning home run skipped behind us in the parking lot. We were not in a position to chase. So the Braves won on a dramatic home run that we almost saw. We ate, we drank, we laughed. A good time had by all, I thought. "How was the game?" Mom asked when we got home. The 9-year-old said, "Alex put a hot dog roll in my drink." The 3-year-old said, "The water fountain didn't work." The baby said, "Wah!" I think that's what they call a grand slam.
That was great. I can tell that the big challenge for me in having you here is to not laugh right out loud in the middle of your reading. That was wonderful. I wanted to ask you about being, is it Mr. Mom for a while there? Now, your wife, I take it, works out of your home?
She works out of the home, and when we had our two youngest, after the Family Leave Act came into being, she took several months off from work, and then when she went back to work, I stayed home after that.
Okay, so you both had time.
We both had time at home. Yeah, it wouldn't have done much good if I had stayed home when she was there, you know, but I was on my own when she went back to work. So, and then the second time, I actually stretched it out doing some part-time work, but I was able to be home during the day when she was at work. So that way we avoided having to do any outside child care for a long time.
And she probably avoided having to take the kids and introduce them to baseball.
That's so. Right. I got to do that.
What else have you brought for us, Bill?
I was going to read one from a couple years after this when our oldest was going to summer camp for the first time. And this was about her preparing to go to summer camp.
Okay.
The 11-year-old spent most of Sunday packing for summer camp. This is her first time going to camp. This is our first time sending her. I guess you could say we're all a little anxious. The night before we loaded the car, my wife figured it would be a good idea to see exactly what our daughter had packed for her 2 weeks of outdoor adventure. At the moment of inspection, the 11-year-old's bags included a dozen pair of underwear, cutting it close in my mind, but possibly adequate, 10 shirts. I'm sure her bunkmates will like seeing a couple of the same shirts 2 or 3 days in a row. 6 or 8 pairs of shorts. If they like repeat wearings of the shirts, they'll love the shorts the third time around. A quote-unquote handful of socks. I was unable to ascertain where handful fits quantity-wise among a couple, a few, and several, but I assumed it did not come particularly close to enough. No hairbrush, which was forgotten. No flashlight, which was temporarily lost. And no laundry bag. Actual question with this, when this issue was raised from her was, what's a laundry bag? And here's the showstopper. 14 bottles of nail polish. At precisely the moment my wife relayed this information to me, I absolutely knew summer camp would be good for our child. As a kid, I never went to camp, so I'm no expert on the proper gear to take along for a couple of weeks in the woods. Something tells me, however, that a bottle of glittery green nail polish would not make the list. Unless you plan to dress the mosquitoes in something garish. This camping business is big stuff. Approximately 9 million kids will attend summer camp this year, according to the American Camping Association. That's a lot of nail polish. Some of those kids will travel great distances for their camping experience. Our daughter didn't go much more than 20 miles from our front door. Short trip, sure, but sometimes you don't have to go far to visit another world. On the drive to camp, she confided that she had written down our home address, quote, in case I get amnesia or something. I hope she remembers where she left it. On the afternoon we dropped her off, the temperature hovered near 100. The air just hovered. I've eaten clam chowder that wasn't as thick or as hot. But she and a friend, who also signed up for this adventure, were thrilled to be within minutes of a parent-free vacation and seemed oblivious to the heat. They were positively giddy over the prospect of sitting around a campfire and squealed with delight when their counselor told them they could roast s'mores. I was desperately trying to get back to the air-conditioned minivan, and they were hopping around all worked up over hot, melted marshmallows. Personally, I think they were crazy from the heat. I say this because they seemed unfazed by the prospect of sleeping in the great outdoors with bugs and snakes and things that I spend a considerable portion of my life trying to avoid. I imagine it has dawned on them by now. My daughter was most concerned about the facilities. It does have indoor plumbing, doesn't it? She asked. It does, but having a mean streak, I made some crack about digging deep holes and hoping for the best. She responding by threatening to, quote, hold it in until I get home. I'm figuring we'll receive a letter from camp on official stationery about the middle of next week. Dear Mr. and Mrs. Lohman, we are very sorry to inform you that your daughter has exploded. Her roommates are even sorrier. Enclosed is their dry cleaning bill, which we expect you to pay immediately. When your check clears, we will send along the surviving bottles of nail polish.
How does a daughter with her glittery green nail polish respond to reading Dad's column?
That was about the last one I wrote about her. Actually, the next summer, we went on a cross-country trip, which became the book that we had, Are We There Yet? Because we did a series for that whole summer when she turned, it was the summer after that, the summer she turned 13. We wrote the whole summer of the series about our travels across the country, and that was about the last time I wrote much about her. Because they get to a certain age. After a certain age, I stop using their names generally in the paper, and then after that, I stop writing about them altogether because they stop. It ceases to be fun for them, and I don't want it to be not fun for them.
Sure, sure. You mentioned your book, and I'm holding it in my hands. Are We There Yet? Tell us a little bit about this.
Well, it was the summer of 2000, and I proposed to the paper that with the dawning of a new century, maybe we consider taking a look at the family vacation, and they said that's a good idea. So we rented a a big van, and we packed everything we owned, and we went out on 7 weeks across the country.
And that did result in a book.
That resulted in the book. I did a series of stories. We wrote 3 or 4 stories a week and sent them back from the road and sent back photographs, and we actually survived and came back, and it was a great adventure.
Great. Are you going to read anything from your book for us
today? I've got one from in there that I picked that we could read.
I know, we'd love to hear it.
I thought I'd read the one about, actually it was another camping related one. It was from our stay in Yellowstone National Park. It was midnight and the 5 of us were snug in our sleeping bags, zipped shut in our cozy tent, lined up in a row like weenies on a grill. Except someone turned off the grill. The temperature had plummeted to near 40 degrees, frightfully cold for Virginians in July, but just right for Yellowstone, the granddaddy of America's national parks. Camping is not my bag, so to speak. I've slept out of doors in a tent only once before, and that was at Maymont, a small city park where the animals were behind walls and glass. Out here in the true wilderness, you're in the animal's backyard. You get the feeling a bear will hold the door for you at the campground's public restroom. Bears are everywhere in Yellowstone. The only thing more prevalent than bears in Yellowstone are warnings about bears in Yellowstone. There are strict rules and regulations about food and trash and where you can store your toothpaste, even. Still, we did not see a single bear during our stay. We saw elk, mule deer, and lots of bison, but no bear. I'm just as glad. I consider it adventurous enough to sleep in the same county with bears. I don't need to see them. I'm pleased to take the ranger's word for them. But back to camping. This was the portion of our cross-country trek I feared the most. I was not excited about sleeping with animals or standing in line to take a shower or hearing other people snore. When I think of fun, camping does not emerge in my top 10. Well, after 4 days in the woods, I can say this. We lived. Not well, but we lived. The tent went up perfectly. Only hitch was that in all of the stuff we crammed into the conversion van, our second air mattress was nowhere to be found. It's somewhere in our house in Richmond doing no one any good at all. The first night we tried sleeping with 2.5 of us on the one mattress and the rest of us on the ground. Alex woke up with condensation on her and her sleeping buddy, a stuffed dog named Mudge. We bought an air mattress at the local camp store the next day. I don't know whether the lack of an air mattress caused our middle child to be covered in dew, but I know it had nothing to do with our youngest, Jack, grinding his teeth in his sleep. He does that anyway, a nice little trait I passed on to him. Usually it's not a big problem since he does it in his own room at home. Here, though, we're all within inches of each other. After a night of Jack crunching his teeth and slapping his gums, my wife, Robin, who had the pleasure of sleeping next to her baby, renamed him Chompy the Goat. Chompy woke up after that first night and announced, quote, "I liked it better when we camped in a hotel." And the bathing. I've been sworn not to disclose how long we went without a formal bath, but I can tell you the sun came up several times between showers. We went into a store in Grand Teton National Park, just south of Yellowstone, and the kindly woman at the counter commented to Robin that she had, quote, "some beautiful children." Robin thought, and relayed to me a few minutes later, it's a good thing she couldn't smell them. I must say, though, camping wound up not being so bad. I'd worried about how well the kids would settle down in the evenings. That really wasn't an issue. We stayed so busy seeing and doing things during the day that by dinner time they were hungry, and by bedtime, which wound up being much later than normal, they were worn out. So they ate and slept. As a parent, you can't ask for much more. We cooked, not extravagantly, but we cooked, on our 2-burner camp stove. Here was an actual conversation. What's for dinner? Pick a can. We built campfires and made s'mores. We slept adequately, if not particularly comfortably. We grew closer as a family. 3 of us actually are attached now. I'm kidding. Mostly, though, we saw Yellowstone and Grand Teton. Nice payoffs for sleeping in a tent. These places are nature's amusement parks. Yellowstone has rivers and lakes and meadows and waterfalls and peaks and canyons and geysers and steaming thermal pools the color of the deepest blue you can imagine. It also has nasty scars from the 1988 fires that burned more than one-third of the park. Wide stands of bare, dead trees still cover many mountainsides. New growth is slowly emerging. It's a natural process, and Yellowstone will be stunning once again, but it makes you ache a little to know how beautiful it must have been. Grand Teton is more of a postcard with its clear lakes butting up against tall, snow-capped peaks. Absolutely gorgeous. The kids will probably remember the night sky. At 7,000 feet, the sky is so big and the stars so bright you feel like you can reach up and take a drink from the Big Dipper. They also probably will recall picking up the horn of a bighorn sheep at a ranger station. 15 pounds that baby weighed. I got a crick in my neck just thinking about it. Alex will remember losing her second front tooth. She can now officially request 2 front teeth for Christmas in the scrambled eggs at Yellowstone's Grant Village campground. Melissa will recall fetching our water from an outdoor spigot. Both girls will never forget the projects they did and the facts they learned to become junior rangers. At the ranger station where Melissa received her badge, the ranger announced to all of the other visitors that Melissa was Yellowstone's newest ranger. They all applauded. I thought Melissa was going to throw up. But what the kids will probably remember most about Yellowstone and Grand Teton are the lunches, and it won't be the peanut butter and jelly that will trigger the warm memories. After watching Old Faithful erupt one morning in Yellowstone, we drove to nearby Biscuit Basin to see more geysers and hot pools. We parked next to the Firehole River, a quick-moving, narrow body of chilly water. We spread a blanket and ate lunch. Other people were waiting, so we did too. It was a fine time, exceeded only by the next day when we ventured down to Grand Teton and picnicked next to Jackson Lake. We pulled out the swimsuits this time and swam in the shadow of a mountain still covered with snow. The sun was hot, the water was cold, the setting was perfect. It was like splashing around in a painting. After a couple of hours of this, Alex spread her tiger blanket on the rocky beach, reclined and said, quote, "No more complaining. This is the life." It truly was almost perfect. The only thing missing was a bar of soap.
Wow. I've got to read that book. Are We There Yet? How do you get Are We There Yet?
I have a box in the attic of them.
Okay.
It's on Amazon.com, and I don't believe it's in any bookstores now because it's been a few years, but I have many copies of it.
Okay. That's wonderful. I'm very serious about that. I would love to read a copy of this, and I know many of our listeners would also love to read Are We There Yet?
Have them contact me at the paper.
Okay. We'll do that. And the best way to get to you at the paper is just what? V. Lohman?
It's W. Lohman.
W-L-O-H-M-A-N-N.
Correct. At timesdispatch.com. Or my direct number is, if that's easier, 649-6639. I'm often not sitting at my desk, but I have voicemail, so I can return calls.
Well, and I know that you do, because you very kindly returned mine. I think we have time for one more piece, Bill. Could you read one more thing for us?
This was what one my son picked out. He keeps a little binder of columns that I've written that included him, and he likes this one. This was from 2002, January. We had a big snow a couple days before this column appeared, and I think I was home that week anyway, but regardless, this ended up being a snow day. Schools were out, and so this was about being a parent on a snow day and keeping your kids occupied, and I've written it in the form of a diary. 11:30 p.m., the day officially begins a half hour early with the teenager checking the school system's cable television channel to see if schools have been canceled for the next morning. It is a minor point that it actually hasn't begun to snow. As a result, school is still on. She briefly considers doing the homework she earlier ignored as her faith in the local meteorologist wavers ever so slightly. But she thinks better of it, checks her email, and goes to bed. 11:40 p.m. The teenager's 8-year-old sister has finally fallen asleep, the anticipation of potential snowfall a greater bedtime disruption than even Mountain Dew. 2:45 a.m. Dad awakes, peeks out the window, sees the lawn, and one, he won't have to resort to bribes or threats of Siberian labor camp tortures to entice anyone out of their warm beds first thing in the morning. But two, schools may be closed until February. He returns to bed to contemplate. 7 a.m. The 5-year-old is first to arise. He announces the snow, asks where his snow pants are, and requests breakfast. He is straightforward, direct, and far too energetic for this early in the morning. 8:30 a.m. The frantic search is on for coats, gloves, and boots that fit. The day is young, but the allure of the snow is already starting to wear off for the grown-ups. 9 a.m. Pancakes hit the griddle. The first batch, I am instructed, are, quote, too brown. It's comforting to know a little frozen precipitation has not affected the household gratitude. 9:10 a.m. Spouse makes a rather disparaging remark about the quantity of leftover Christmas ham nestled next to the pancakes on my plate. She doesn't buy the explanation that I'm storing up for the rest of the winter. 10 a.m. Two youngest children gleefully dash headlong into the snow. 10.02 a.m. After a brief investigation, Kat reconsiders and slinks back inside to her bed. 10.14 a.m. Pristine snow and surrounding quiet are shattered by the first sibling dispute, which took less time to develop than it did for them to get dressed to frolic in this winter wonderland. Frolic turns out to be another word for a five-year-old hollering and chasing his eight-year-old sister around the yard with a large chunk of snow in his hand. I'm hoping he doesn't catch her, but the smart money says he will. 10.16 a.m. Scream indicates the smart money was right. 10.45 a.m. Teenager awakes, figuring 1, school is canceled, or 2, at the very least, she missed the bus big time. A look outside bolsters her faith in the Weather Channel, now her favorite channel next to the school system's public access channel, which she immediately turns on to see if the school will be canceled for the next day. It hasn't. 11.05 a.m. I find our old wooden sled temporarily distracting our youngest combatants. I pull each of them to the corner of the next block. I return home and lean against the car in our driveway, hoping my pounding heart doesn't leap out and poke a hole in my Polar Tech. 11.45 a.m. I make 2 big steaming mugs of hot chocolate. The youngest 2 love the notion of hot chocolate. 12.45 p.m. I throw out 2 big lukewarm mugs of hot chocolate. They love the notion a lot more than the taste. 2 p.m. Outdoor time over, I direct the children to the shelves and shelves of books, games, puzzles, and art projects that await them. 2.10 p.m. Children argue. 2.11 p.m. One child sent to do her homework. 2 others sent to garage to play with a cat, or play ping pong, or both, but not at the same time. No paddling the cat, I remind them. 4.20 p.m. While working in the other room, I hear the teenager chatting with her 5-year-old brother, who has a wad of cash stashed in his, quote, office, and a tendency to borrow money from his sisters. "Where'd you get all that money?" she asked. He said, "Mommy and Daddy gave me money for being good," and then added, "and I've been very good." Well, neither part of that sentence is true, but it's apparently a conversation stopper as his sister goes on to another topic and heads to the TV where, at 4.25 p.m., she discovers school has been canceled for the next day, lets out a whoop, and shares the wonderful news with the rest of the family. 4.26 p.m., I wonder, how long till February?
Wonderful. And you have been wonderful to come and join us for this series, Phil. Thank you.
Glad to be here. Thank you, Patty.
We've been talking with Richmond Times-Dispatch columnist Bill Lohman. I'm Patty Campbell for the Virginia Voice.
You've been listening to The Writer's Voice on The Virginia Voice.